This is episode number 749 of the Secret Identity Podcast. Today we're going to talk about Lake of Fire number 1, Battlestar Galactica number 1, All New Wolverine the Annual number 1, and Josie and the Pussycats number 1. Our creator spotlight this week will be Daryl McDaniels, otherwise known as DMC, who Matt sat down with at New York Comic Con 2016.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you.
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
You have 20 seconds to comply.
And welcome everybody to Secret Identity. This is Brian Latenry here, as always, with the lovely, the talented, the beautiful Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
I'm a little nervous right now because I realized something.
What's that?
That in a few hours, the Nationals will be playing the Dodgers. Winner goes to play the Cubs in the National League Championship.
We started the last episode talking about music, yep, which people yell at us for. Now you're going to start talking about sports right out of the gate?
This is a tough one, though. This is very, like,
you haven't heard me talk about how the Chargers are the worst team in the NFL and continually find ways to break my heart.
Oh, they're breaking your heart.
People don't
want to
hear about that, Matthew.
No, they want comic books.
I will wish your Nationals good luck because I hate the Dodgers.
Yes.
I also hate the Giants. Giants have already been knocked out.
See you later.
I'm rooting for the Nationals tonight.
Very good.
I talk about hockey, but the Canucks are picked to finish last in the NHL this year, so it's pretty much a banner year for my sports teams as usual.
You know, that was my 30 years, though. I mean, it hasn't been, I have not always enjoyed, or 20 years.
Listen, you can no longer play that card, all right?
No, I can't
anymore. Your teams are on a ridiculous run.
Yep.
I'm still just heartbreak kid day after day. The good news, folks, today is that we really don't have any news so much to speak of in this episode. So we're going to jump right into your comic books. And we're going to start off today with a book that I am extremely fired up about. And fire's in the title, Matthew. Wow. Lake of Fire, number 1, illustrated by Matt Smith, written, colored, and lettered by Nathan Fairbairn. The cover by Matt Smith and Nathan Fairbairn. This was created by Matt Smith and Nathan Fairbairn. And let me tell you, I have not been this impressed with a first issue in a very long time. It is just out by, actually the second one just came out. It's a series from Image, and I really didn't know much about it going into it, but boy, oh boy, this is a top-notch from top to bottom book. We start off, Matthew, in the year 1220 in the French Pyrenees. This is about the time of the Fifth Crusade.
Yes.
And you have a small shack where a shepherd is living and his flock is outside. All of a sudden, you hear some movement. The animals start getting a little bit crazy. He goes outside to see what's going on. And all of a sudden, a gigantic mechanical-looking construct is streaming across the sky. He immediately is, holy God, please, starts praying, falls down to his knees, you know, in the name of the Father. And because we're in the year 1220, and a spaceship has just crashed down on the ground. So out of the gate, you might be thinking to yourself, like, okay, I've seen stories like this before. You know, some older time, a ship turns up in. But there was something about this book from the beginning. First of all, the colors, the artwork, absolutely stunningly gorgeous. The shot of the ship against the backdrop of the starry sky sort of hitting down is crazy. Big smoke and fire coming out around whatever landed here. He goes to see what it is, and all of a sudden he sees something coming toward him that has very large teeth, and that's all that you see of this particular shepherd. Now, in contrast, this all happened in the dark of night. You see a bright and sunny day as these two, basically kids, are walking through the mountains. You have a very young, and they're dressed in sort of knight and squire's outfits. And so they are hunting for birds, and they're walking along this sort of hilly path and they're talking. And one of the guy's names is Theo. He's the one that has the big red cross on his chest. Mm-hmm. And then you have Hugh, I believe, who is the other kid who's with him. And they're probably like 16, 17 years old. And they're talking about how, you know, they have to keep their strength up on the road. And Hugh is kind of teasing Theo about, yeah, our journey's kind of taken a long time and we've gotten into the wine and we've kind of eaten most of our food. And Theo's telling him, hey, man, you don't have to worry about it because the great news is, look at over this hillside. Look down there. He says, you know, we're nearly there. The siege of Castel Nodri lies before us. What difference will a few days make to the soldiers of God? He says, you know, so we're a few days late. It's no big deal. Tomorrow, we are going to go down there and we are going to join up with these guys and we're going to join God's great crusade. And so you have these two young kids who are basically going to join the crusade. And so the next day, you see down in the encampment that is outside of this big, you know, city, that there is a guy by the name of Lord Montfort who is in charge of the forces in this area, and Theo and Hugh go to see him. And when they're shown in to see this Lord Montfort, he's not happy to see them. He's like, oh boy, here we go. Well, apparently his family and the family of Theo and the family of Hugh have a history together. Their parents were all soldiers and stuff like that. And so you have Theo coming and saying, Lord, Montfort, this is great. We're here now. Our families are reunited. We're going to join up with you and it's going to be glorious. We're joining the crusade and blah, 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 blah. You know, do you think that our fathers would have imagined that their sons would someday answer the same call as they did? And Lord Montfort's like, I can't imagine they did, nor would I imagine they visioned that the utter debacle that their own crusade would end in. So you got this Lord Montfort guy who is kind of like, yeah, things didn't end well for our fathers, and I don't know why you're so excited about running and jumping in here, especially because you're so young. And he says, so what are you guys doing here? And he's like, oh, well, we want to, you know, put us to work. Let us show us where we need to go. And he says, well, at first I need to call in someone that's been waiting for you. And you see this guy by the name of Count Henry, who is a friend of Theo's mother. And Theo's mother sent him here to wait for him to arrive and then to bring him back home. And so Count Henry is saying, look, you're a kid. You know, you pretty much announced to everybody in town that you were going to go join the crusade. And your mother sent me here to make sure that you don't do that. So I'm here to bring you back. You're not even, you know, you're a squire. And he says, actually, I'm a knight. And he says, what are you talking about? And he says, oh, yeah, we had, you know, who was it that this lord made me a knight. And so now I'm a knight. And the guy's like, oh, that drunk made you a knight. So he basically convinced somebody to knight him. And now he is coming to join the crusade. And he says, there's nothing that you can do to stop me. I anyone, be they a peasant or a farmer or anybody else, can pick up the cross and become part of the crusade. I'm allowed to do this. And I'm not going anywhere. And so Lord Montfort is listening to all of this and he's kind of eyeing them. And this is where I have to say, like, the artwork in this book is like watching like a Studio Ghibli film or watching some of the old school, really well done, like Disney hand animation. The facial expressions, the storytelling that's happening as you're watching, like, Lord Montfort watched this and kind of rolling his eyes and seeing that it's not going to be as easy as just having Count mm-hmm. Henry take the kid out of here. And so he says, okay. So you want to join the crusade, but do you really want to just go and lay siege to this place that we're at now? Is that really why you came all this way? And Theo says to him, well, I mean, what else would you have me do? And he says, in truth, I have just the thing for you. And what you see, he says, what do you know about the spread of heresy in the village of Montelion? And Montelieu, I think it is. So basically what he's done now is this lord has created a wild goose chase for them to go on. Because in the Crusades, you know, they're trying to stamp out any sort of heresy.
Yes. Against the church.
Anything non-Christian. And so he says, well, I've heard that there's this village where I think we need you guys to go investigate because I think there's some heresy going on there. And so he just picked that name out of a hat, basically, and decides to go and send them to it. So the next thing you know, you see that there is a mother and her daughter in the woods, and they're gathering mushrooms and they're gathering wood and all this kind of stuff, and they end up getting attacked by the same creature that killed the shepherd a night before. And it seems like this is happening near that Montelieu. And so Lord Montfort goes to the stables and finds this drunken knight and kicks him in the foot and says, "I need you to get up, Raymond. You're going to be the head of this new expedition that I got going on over here." And he says, what is it? And he basically says, "Well, it's a fool's errand, and I find myself in need of a leader." So you've got a drunken, disgraced knight, a kid who has no business being a knight that just got himself knighted, and basically his best friend. The count that was sent to bring them home are now all part of this mission to go to this village to root out heresy. And along with them are sent some monks, one of whom is basically an inquisitor. And so all of the people that Lord Montfort didn't want to deal with, he basically is sending on this mission and saying, "You guys are going to go because I've heard there's some nefarious things going on over in this village. You go and you make sure that you show them no mercy to any of the heretics." And as they go off, one of his right-hand men is saying, "My lord, what's going on in this Montelieu? Like, is the heresy so strong there?" He says, "Oh, I have no idea. I just basically made that up, and I'm sending these guys out of here. But then I don't have to deal with any of these fools. And by the time they come back 40 days from now, their term will be over, and I won't have to worry about them anymore." So next thing you know, they're camping in the woods that night, and you have Theo, the young plucky knight who wants to play his lute. And Raymond, the old drunkard of a knight, says to him, "I will make you eat that thing if you even play one tune on it." And they're saying, "Well, why? What's going on?" He says, "I'll give you two good reasons. One of them is that I don't want to hear it. And the other one is that you see that guy over there, one of the friar over there?" And they're like, "Oh, Brother Arnaud, is that who you're talking about?" And he says, "Yeah, he's basically an inquisitor. And what's going to happen is he is always looking for heresy. And so if you pick up your stupid instrument and you play a song wrong, or he doesn't like the way it sounds, maybe he starts thinking that you're a heretic." Mm. And the thing is, if we go to this village and we don't find what we're looking for, he's going to find it anyways, because that's what they do. And so he's trying to explain to him that, like, you don't want to ruffle any feathers out of the gate here, pal, because the people that are in this group with us, they could turn on you just as easily, not to mention I'll kill you if you play the stupid thing. So the kid gets upset and takes a swing at him. And Raymond cracks him one good and says, "You know, continue to act the fool and it's going to cost you." So he kind of smacks the kid down on the first night and shows that he's no one to be messed with. Next day, they get to Montelieu. As they get to the outskirts of the village, they find no one. They find what looks to be a bloody doll in the road. It looks like nobody's in the village. The farm is untended. The crops haven't been touched for the past few days. And they're saying, "Well, why would this be happening?" And then they see that there is sort of the fort, you know, the one building in the entire village where everybody can sort of gather around and try to defend the place. And it's got a big fence around it and stuff like that. And he says, "Great. They're in there. Awesome." So the drunken guy goes up and starts banging on the gate and says, let us in, you know, or we're going to tear the whole place down. And one guy pokes his head up and says, I'm John Clarigue, bailiff of Montelieu. What is your business here?" And he says, "My business is to shove 3 feet of steel up your arse if you don't open this stupid door." And so Count Henry goes, "Why don't you let me handle this one?" And he goes up and he gets him to open the door. And when they go in, what they find is injured and terrified villagers inside. And the villagers are looking at them like, "Have you guys come to save us?" And the youngest kid, the sort of squire, says, "My lords, what happened to these people?" And one of the women looks up and says, "It was demons." And all of a sudden, everybody's like, "Oh, hold on a second." And, you know, the monk immediately says, "What heresy is this?" And he says, "Please tell me what happened here." And she says, "Look, you know, it all started a fortnight ago. Thunder and lightning on the north on a clearing cloud this night. Shepherds stopped coming to town. Soon women and children who were foraging in the forest started to disappear. And then last night they attacked as we slept. They have claws. They have all this other kind of stuff. you have to help us. Now, of course, after she tells this story and everybody's all upset, the monk says, I will hear no more of this. You will not divert us from rooting out the heresy in this village. So he thinks it's all just a farce. Mm-hmm. And so as he's sort of berating her, she mentions that there is good woman Bernadette who lives in the woods, who sees herself as a prefect. And she, you know, comes and sells her wares in town every once in a while, but she sort of lives out there, and he decides to zero in on her and says, oh, so she's the heretic I'm looking for. Okay, so he decides to go off in the woods chasing after this young woman and ends up finding her, and the young squire ends up sort of subduing her, and she freaks out because she's a prefect. You're not supposed to touch her. Mm-hmm. And so she freaks out because this kid is trying to subdue her, and she ends up coming with them. But as they're walking back through the woods towards the village, they get attacked. And they get attacked by these creatures that look like nothing that they've ever seen before. And that's kind of how the first issue ends. And so you have this group of ragtag crusaders who get sent on an errand that is supposed to be absolutely nothing. They get to the village. The village is decimated. And there actually is something out in the woods that's been attacking people. And now it's attacking them. And that's the way the first issue ends. So I did not do that justice at all. I will tell you, it was amazing. It is a fantastic first issue. And it only gets better in the second issue, because what you get in this first issue is a handful of characters that are so well developed from the first time you see them and solidified by the end of the issue that you know who each of these characters is by the time you get to the end of that issue. It's a joy to read from a storytelling and sort of a setup standpoint of how much depth that they've added to these characters. It really was very impressive, and I didn't know what to think about it, but it made me go and look up this time period and see that there was an actual siege that happened. In reality, it happened a few years later than the timeline here of where they're sort of camped out outside of this, you know, the city that they're about to lay siege to and stuff like that. But they've done a nice job of sort of inserting this into this particular timeline where this stuff was going on in that area of France at that particular time. And it's kind of awesome. So it's, I think, respectful of history while adding something completely different as well.
A lot of scope in that.
Oh, it's huge.
It's a huge plethora of amazing things, disturbing things, crazy things that were going on in that time period.
And I think you would love it. It's a double-sized first issue, and it just – the characters are so good that it feels epic right out of the gate. Really, really impressive.
So speaking of epic, once again, Dynamite has a number one Battlestar Galactica. Now,
when you said that, I'm like, again?
Yeah. It's really interesting that they have this property – yet they haven't been able to do anything with it to keep it going, to keep it interesting, to maintain the integrity of what you want from Battlestar Galactica. Now, this is the old school Galactica, so this is the stuff that I like. And we are starting out with, and I'll tell you the creative team on this, Cullen Bunn is the writer,
yep.
Great writer. Alex Sanchez is the artist, colors by Daniel Miwa, and letters by Sal Caprino, editor Matt Idelson. And we start out with the Galactica, which is under that red alert where the whole ship goes red. And then in the old episodes, the alarm would go off. You'd see the stock footage of everybody running and pilots in their little transports going over all these things that were happening. And as this is going on, the pilots are like, what's going on? And they said, is another Cylon attack? And said, you know what? We haven't been attacked in a while. I don't know what's going on. And we haven't been scrambled. We don't know what's going on. Usually, if it's an attack, they tell us, go to your ships.
Right.
We're all just kind of getting ready. And on the bridge, you see that something is going on. And as it's happening, you've turned the page and you see the Galactica is just hit by this huge beam of light. Starts shaking the ship. They're realizing that something's going on is that they are being sucked into a black hole. And they don't know what to do.
I'm pretty sure that's not good.
No, they've never encountered anything like this. Now, the Galactica can kind of fight it, but they have 100 other ships that are being dragged along with them that can't and may not be able to survive this. So there's a little bit of a panic. Some of the ships are being destroyed, and all of a sudden, you're seeing how the crews are all reacting to everything going on, but all of a sudden, something happens on the bridge where a piece of the ceiling falls in and hits Commander Adama. So he's laying there on the ground out. And then the ship, Colonel Ty takes over and says, you know, we're, this is Colonel Ty and this is what's going on. And he's trying to say, and you keep hearing that things are breaking through. The audio is being broken up as they're going through. And they're saying, you know, some of our instruments and navigations aren't working. We're in a black hole. A lot of ships are reporting significant damage. Just do what you can to hold together. We'll get through this and we'll figure it out from there. And meanwhile, Commander Dama is now in the sick bay. And you remember the Seinfeld episode with the Russian writer? And he was, yeah, and just all mean. He threw Elaine's tape recorder out of the...
Yes.
He played the doctor in Battlestar Galactica. He was the ship's doctor. I forgot his name. So every time I see him drawn in a comic, I think of him whipping, you know, electric organizer out of a window.
Uh-huh.
So he is there talking to the crew, and they're like, so what's going on with the commander? And he says, well, we don't know. He's alive. His brain is working. He's in sort of a coma, but we don't know what's going on. Something's happening, and we don't know how to get him out of it. And Apollo goes, is he dreaming? He goes, I don't know. I don't know what's going on, but something is definitely going on inside of his head. So all of a sudden, you're seeing what's going on in Adama's head, and he has this dream where he is hearing a voice saying, your presence is required. So he walks outside the door of the cabin on the Galactica, and all of a sudden, he's outside, and he's face-to-face with Baltar. And he says, Baltar, is it you who called me? And you see that he's on the planet. Now, what happened was maybe three or four episodes before the series, the original series ended, they captured Baltar, but they didn't want to keep him with them on the ship, so they left him on some planet. And Adama's like, is this the planet that we left you on? And he goes, how did I get here? And he says, you never really left. He goes, you've been on this planet the entire time. And he says, you're stranded here just like I am. So Adama's like, I don't know, this doesn't feel right. I feel guilt over what I did, but you betrayed our people. And, you know, I don't understand what's going on. I shouldn't have shown you any mercy. And he says, Commander, you know, I found hell. And he's like, what's going on? And then he's looking into Baltar's eyes, and it's all swirling. And he says, I found hell for both of us. And then all of a sudden, after a few more brief flashbacks, he's back on the bridge of the Galactica. And it's still a dream. And what's really cool is that in the dream sequence, the colors are all a little off. Like, it's one page is all red palette with slight colors, but the borders are all edged out, so you know he's dreaming. And he's like, what's going on, Commander Ty? And he says, Commander, we're under siege. The Cylons are attacking. And Commander Ty's like, again? And he goes, you know, where'd they come from? And he says, the Cylons have broken the peace accord. They betrayed us. That is the very first thing that happens in the first Galactica episode. So he's basically reliving the destruction of the colonies all over again. And he's like, can we stop it? Is there any time? And now we go back and the ships have scrambled. The ships are out in space as they're flying through this black hole or the other side of it. And they come up on a planet and they're looking, saying, you know, would you look at that? And he goes, I don't know what's going on here, but there's really weird because we're getting this huge reading of metal and stuff. And we don't know what it is. And it's like Saturn, a ring around Saturn, but it's all metal. So it's probably broken ships. It's all stuff that's going on. And they said, oh, I bet you this is what's left of the first people to come to this sector. They said, you know, that they indicate that the planet is fine below. And we're also hearing, we're also getting life readings. So we probably should go down and see what's going on. So the ships land. And it looks like it's Apollo, Starbuck, Boomer, and Athena. And not Athena. I forgot his. It'll come to me. Not Cassiopeia. I forgot his. It's the one he ended up marrying later on. Sheba. Thank you. Named after a cat.
I was just going to say that.
It was named after a cat food, which when it came out, I remember being like, we got to get Sheba because that was Apollo's girlfriend.
I literally don't remember anybody's names except for Starbuck, Apollo, Adama, Ty.
Throw Boxy in there.
Baltar.
That's it. That's it?
Yeah.
So as they land, they're looking around, and all of a sudden, all these aliens start walking up around them. And it's interesting because every alien looks a little bit different. And they're saying, oh, the gods have shined on us on this day. It's time to celebrate. It's a gracious day. And they're talking, you know, hey, you guys fell from the heavens. This is great. One of the interesting things about the original Battlestar Galactica, and they did it with the second one as the relaunch as well, is that it never was the Alien of the Month show or the Alien of the Week. You never saw a lot of alien races in either one of the incarnations. So to see all these like blue creatures and things like that, very humanoid, but obviously different, all standing around was pretty weird. And then they come up to a crater and they're all, then there is this a crash site? And they're like, what kind of ship would have made this? So Starbuck's like, oh, I'm going down there to find out what's going on. And they're saying, wait a minute, you know what? Instead of climbing down to the bottomless pit, maybe we should kind of ask these people what's going on. And you see that all the people are staring. And now the Cylons, you go to the Cylons, they're now entering this area too, where they're coming into an unknown space. And you have Lucifer, who is the guy with the shiny glowing head.
Oh, yeah.
Is coming in, and he's talking to the Cylon centurions that are assembled. And he's like, you know what? The humans are out there. Get your ships out there. We need to find them. We're in uncharted territory. But again, we're an empire, and this is what we do. So he's excited in the fact that he's thinking they're going to be claiming another area. And then when you turn the page, you see that the Cylons are coming in. And as they are getting ready, there's something coming in that's attacking them. And when you turn the page, one of the centurions is saying, it's Cylons that are attacking us. We're being attacked by ourselves. And the first thing that I thought was, oh, don't let it be like the new Cylons where you're now getting this Galactica mash.
Yeah.
And it's just old school Galactica Cylon ships versus old school Galactica Cylon ships.
Which is what you want.
That's what I want. I just want to see robot on robot action. So a great way to start it. It took me a little while to get used to Alex Sanchez's art. His art is great. I've seen him in a lot of other things, but to me, Galactica has a distinct look, and he definitely is not fitting the look of it, but he does a great job. And it took me a little while. And Cullen Bunn, you know, the guy can write the phone book right about now. He seems to be on all cylinders with what he writes. So definitely check it out.
Yeah, I have not gotten into any of the Battlestar Galactica comics with the exception of the very first one that they launched based on the new TV show.
And it was the 25-cent issue that started it.
Yes.
Yep.
That was literally the only one that I got. And I can't remember how far down that series I got.
That was a great series, too. I think it went maybe 20, 25 issues, something like that.
And I want to say I probably got the first 12 or something like that. So
it was good stuff.
All right, Matthew. Well, I'm going to go back to the Marvel Universe. I feel like a couple weeks ago, it was all DC all the time. And I even now, as I at home look at my, you know, not only my pull list, but like what I have there for a backlog. Uh-oh. I don't think this is going to be a smooth transition to the code. Nope, it did. Oh, that's too bad. Well, no code today.
Oh, boy.
It didn't work out. We'll have to post one on the website. But I feel like we did so many of the DC Rebirth books, and we will continue to talk about DC Rebirth, that I did want to mention at least some of the Marvel books that I'm still actually reading and enjoying. So we're going to talk about All New Wolverine Annual Number 1. Now, this story takes place before the events of Civil War II. So it's an annual, which most of the time, you know, the annual story is just sort of a fun sort of one-off. You have Tom Taylor writing this. Marcio Takara is the artist. Matt Lopes is the colorist. And Corey Pettit does the letters here. Let's see who is the editor. Christina Harrington, assistant editor. Mark Paniccia is the editor on this one. So for those of you that don't know, X-23 is the new Wolverine. And she has been for this first series, which I want to say is up to at least like issue 12 now or something like that. In the first storyline, she was dealing with clones of herself. And when that whole storyline resolved herself, there was one clone left, and her name was... is it Gabby? Yep, it is Gabby. So her young clone Gabby, she recently allowed to move in with her. So basically you have Laura, you have Gabby, the young girl who is a younger version of herself living with her, and they also have a pet Wolverine. And that pet Wolverine is Jonathan. That's his name. And so they have this pet Wolverine, Jonathan, and as we open this particular story, they're in the Bronx. You have Gabby, who is creating a outfit for Jonathan. She's saying, you know, you have to protect your secret identity, so we're going to make you an outfit. She hears some sort of bright light sort of crash go on in the other room, and she runs into the other room and sees Laura there, and Laura's screaming, and she says, what's wrong? She says, stay back. And she jumps out of the window, and you see her try to shoot a web, and it doesn't work, and she crashes into the top of a car that's parked on the street outside. And what we come to find out pretty quickly, as Gabby runs outside and says, "We need to get you back in because I don't know what's going on right now, but you're acting really weird." She says, "What are you talking about? My name is Gwen Stacy." And as she says that, you now flash over to Gwen's world, where Gwen is on stage with the Mary Janes, her band, and they are about to start a gig, and she is the drummer for that band. And all of a sudden, you have Mary Jane saying to her, "You know, traditionally, after a drummer counts to four, they start drumming." And Gwen is like, and then she puts her hand down right through the snare drum, and she basically runs out of there. And when she runs outside, her father, Captain Stacy, is waiting for her outside. He's saying, "Oh, how did the gig go? Did it go well? Like, you know, let me give you a ride home." She closes the door and she slams it so hard the window smashes. So she gets home and she's absolutely freaking out because she knows that she's not in the right body either. So we have a Freaky Friday thing going on here where you have Gwen, who is in the body of X-23 back in the 616, and you have Laura, who is in the body of Gwen Stacy in Gwen's universe. And she gets home, and as soon as she gets home, she looks outside, and there's a spaceship landing in her backyard, and it's the Reed Richards of the Stacy universe. And he's a kid, and he comes in, and he says, "Why don't you, I didn't need to talk to you for a quick second. Why don't you come over here and let me tell you what's going on?" And he says, "Look, I detected some sort of anomaly. I figured out that there's some sort of body swapping thing going on. Here's the problem, though. You only have a few hours to fix it. And so I'm going to send you to the 616 so that you can go and try and fix that with Gwen herself, because if you guys don't, then the change is going to be permanent." And so all of a sudden, Gwen Stacy shows up in the 616. And so the whole story is about the two of them trying to work together when neither one of them understands how the other's powers work. So that's why, you know, when Gwen jumped out the window in Laura's body, she tried to spin a web, didn't work, fell through a car, and was able to heal. Well, Gwen Stacy doesn't have that type of healing power. So it's that whole kind of, you know, Freaky Friday thing going on. Well, come to find out, there was a woman who is a scientist, and Wolverine was responsible for killing her uncle. And so this villain tracked down Wolverine, not knowing that it was Laura, and decided to banish Wolverine's consciousness to another dimension, but instead ended up getting Laura and switching her with Gwen Stacy. And so as they're talking, it seems like this person might actually turn out to be a supporting character in the Wolverine book itself. But in this one, she's sort of a misguided villain where she, basically did the wrong thing. But the funniest part of this whole book is that when they break into this person's lair, she's like, you know, they're going to fight her now. And so you have Gwen, who's inside of X-23's body, and she says, "It's time to cut you out of that suit." And she snicked her claws. And as she's doing that, you hear Laura yelling from Gwen's body, "No, you want to move your fists away from your face before you do that." And then off camera, you just see everybody like turn away. And the villain's like, "I think I'm going to be sick." Like, she starts gagging and stuff over in the corner. So yeah, she stabbed herself in the face, which is pretty funny. They did a nice joke about that in the Spider-Man cartoon. Actually, that reminds me now as I'm reading this. This is basically a riff on the Freaky Friday episode of the Drake Bell Spider-Man cartoon that Man of Action does, because they did one with Wolverine.
Yeah.
Where Spidey woke up one morning and he was in Wolverine's body and Wolverine was in his body. Now I need to go back and watch that.
Yeah.
Because this whole thing is a nod to that particular episode. So yeah, obviously by the end of the issue, they end up swapping bodies back and everything's all well and good. And the whole issue itself was pretty much a lighthearted superhero team-up story. But what's cool is as you get to the back of the issue, you have the all-new Wolverine concept art from every artist that has worked on the series so far. And I'll show it to you, Matthew.
Oh, wow.
But it's always kind of cool when you see different artists' interpretation of the character and the supporting characters as well. And so it's cool to see, you know, David Lopez and Marcio Takara and Iguara, their different takes on the character, some of them much more sort of realistic and some of them much more sort of cartoony. That stuff is kind of cool. And then it's an advertisement for the 13th issue. So it is through 12 issues now that we've gone through with the new Wolverine. I actually like this series. Like, I liked the first storyline. I thought it started out strong, and I like the sort of sidekick that her younger clone has become. So if you haven't been checking out the all-new Wolverine, then I believe things start with a new story arc with issue number 13. I wish that I could give you a code for this annual, but unfortunately, it did not work out the way that I wanted it to.
It didn't make it. I think for a while we were giving away so many, but then we were just starting to rip them all.
Well, the problem was, especially like in the hot weather, the glue just melts to the page. Whereas when things get a little crisper, I think that might be a little easier to manage. So.
Yeah, I'll throw a couple up on the Facebook page.
Awesome.
I've got a bunch, so I'll throw some up there. So the last new book we're going to be talking about today is Josie and the Pussycats, number one, from Archie. This is now the latest in the relaunch of Archie, of all the titles. And Marguerite Bennett and Cameron Diordio are the writers on this one. Art by Audrey Muck and coloring by Andrei Stasmanowicz. Jack Morelli is the letterer. And, of course, Mike Pellerito along with Alex Segura are the editors on this one.
Nice.
So great. Really been a good run so far with the new stuff. And wondering if Josie was ever going to get a new look other than the fact that they were vampired out in the afterlife of Archie. So,
but is this an ongoing or a limited series?
It looks like it's an ongoing.
Really?
As far as I know, it's going to be an ongoing. And the cool thing is you get a bunch of new covers, so 6-9 different covers. Marguerite Sauvage does a Abbey Road one, which is the one that I was looking for that I wanted to get. You get a good choice of all the different styles, and they definitely give you that rock and roll feel to them. So we start out with Josie, and she's on stage, and she's got a beautiful purple dress, and she is singing, and you're just seeing roses all over the place. And she is just hitting it on all cylinders. And then you turn the page, and you see that she is at a place, a juice bar, and she is doing open mic night, and there is nobody there. And she's like, what just happened? And the guy says, the girl behind the counter says, oh, you know what? Well, everybody left, and not a good thing. You know, and she's like, why do you still have me here? And she's like, well, we're friends. And, you know, I know you want to be here. And, you know, I know you have this dream of being a singer. And unfortunately, it just isn't really working right now. So all of a sudden, Alexandra comes walking in. And Alexandra's like, oh, I got here as quick as I could. It sounded like there was a cat dying. And no, that was just Josie's dreams. And Alexandra is the same. She is a rotten human being. She is in there and she is just blasting Josie about all the crap and bad stuff going on. And she's like, whoa, this must have set a record for the most people not to show up at an event. And she's like, you know what? Josie's really talented. It's not the fact that, you know, she was just born a few decades late. You know, this is the kind of music she's making. And they're like, oh yeah, you know, she's just riding her and it's just nonstop. So as she is going on and on and on, and she goes, well, Alexandra goes, well, I'm going to go home and listen to something more pleasant, like my garbage disposal. And she's like, oh, yeah, well, you leaving. That's garbage disposal. And Alexandra kind of
smirks.
That's
a good one.
That was a good one.
The jerk store called.
Yep. They're running out of you. So she's like, you know, well, maybe she's right. I am the worst. And she goes, no, you got to believe in yourself. Hey, by the way, there's a concert to benefit the Riverdale Animal Shelter. And all bands can play, and and you want to sign in. And she goes, well, thanks, Pepper. I really appreciate you believing in me. She gets home, and Melody is there, and she's like, hey, guess what? We got a new plan. And she's like, no other new plan. She goes, we're going to dress up like a couple Disney princesses and sing some tunes and save some fluffy bunnies at this shelter thing. And she's like, what do you mean? Do they talk? And she goes, what do you mean, do they talk? She goes, well, the animals, because we're going to dress like Disney princesses. She goes, no, you're kind of missing this. And they're definitely playing up the not very bright Melody in this one. And in the old books, too, Melody would walk out and guys would just be falling all over her. So they have her kind of like that again, where she's going between, you know, do I volunteer for this? And she's basically picking what she volunteers on the guy that is going to be involved with her in this. So she says, hey, you know what? I got a date. I'm going to head out right now. And she's like, but you know what? We'll talk about that cat thing. And as she's walking the streets with her date, the guy's talking about all these things and, you know, how great he is. And all of a sudden, as she's walking, she, you know, and Josie and Melody's kind of like, well, I kind of do this. You know, I play sports and, you know, I teach orphans to read. And she looks up and sees a cat in the street. And the cat's just looking at her all sad. And she starts to cry. And she runs up to the cat. And she's like, hey, Melody, they won't allow animals at the restaurant. She goes, it's a cat. She goes, look, our reservation is 9:00. We need to get there. I had to, you know, just because you're saving an animal doesn't mean this. And she's like, it's a cat. And he's like, look, our night's going to be full of all this crazy stuff. You got to leave the animal. And she's like, it's a cat and we're not leaving. And she goes, you know what? Why don't you leave? So she stays with the cat. And then all of a sudden the next day, she brings the cat with Josie to the animal shelter, which is doing the benefit. And they meet somebody who's working in there who is named Valerie. And I don't think Valerie is the vet. I think she just works with the animals and she's sort of an assistant. And she goes in there and they go in and see all the animals and all of a sudden Melody is gone. She's like, oh my gosh, cat, dog, kitten, you know, going all over the place. She's grabbing and touching every animal. And by this time, all the animals are all fired up. So Melody or Valerie, to calm them down, starts to sing. And they're like, oh my gosh, you've got an amazing voice. And she goes, well, you know, I'm flattered. I appreciate that. She goes, I've been, you know, singing by myself for years and used to sing in church, but I really wouldn't mind doing something. So the three of them talk and say, how about we get together and we rehearse a song for this big show? And she goes, oh, the show that's going to start in 6 hours. And she's like, okay, well, we're going to have to work hard. So they go together. They work on some stuff. And then when they're up there, they're kind of playing and Josie's singing and people just aren't digging it. They're not liking it. What's going on? And then, of course, Alexandra's there with Alex, her brother. The two of them go up and just start blasting them how bad they are, how terrible. But to make it worse, they start going up to each individual member and kind of planting the seeds of dissension. You know, Valerie, you've got a better voice than Josie. Why is she singing? You know, Melody, why are you behind the drums when you should be up front? Because you should be the focal point. And all of a sudden, they start thinking about these things. And then when they get together, they start arguing back and forth. They start talking, you know, rudely to each other. And then Josie pulls up and says, look, wait a minute. You know, you're right. I think this isn't, I don't think you guys are my solo band. We're a band. We're the Pussycats. And this is how we're going to do it. And they go out and play and they say, Valerie, why don't you sing? So Valerie starts singing. Everybody starts enjoying it. And then when they're done, you know, they talk about what the name of the band's going to be and they come up with Josie and the Pussycats. And all of a sudden this guy comes up saying, you know, hey, I'm a record producer and I really would like to work with you guys. And you see it's Alan M, who Alan M is sort of the love interest to Josie back in the old issues. So you see them. And so you're seeing all the characters being introduced. This was a lot of fun, but it was really weird to have Valerie kind of be the one to jump out. And I always talk about the issues where Valerie and Archie got together and they were dating for a while is some of my favorite comics ever written. So I love Valerie's character. It's just really weird to see her up in the front, but I'm pretty sure that that's all going to change around and see, but I'm really looking forward to see where they're going to go with it. And like every great Archie, the relaunches that have been coming out, you get a little bit of a summary of the history of Josie, and then you turn the page and you get sort of the introduction of their costumes. You know, the 5 or 6 pages. Malgren wrote it, and Dan DiCarlo was the penciler. Rudy Lapik is the inker. Bill Yoshida does the letters. And it's just the creation of their costumes and how they did it and where the whole idea came from. And back then, too, Alexandra had magical powers, which I didn't realize.
I did not either.
So I've got to kind of do a little research on that one, because she does a incantation of, oh, witchcraft powers, take that broom and sweep my brother out of the room. And then the broom knocks him out of the room. So something I got to look at, because I never knew that that happened. And then they show them playing their first concert with their cat costumes. Everybody freaks out. Everybody loves them. The interesting thing about how this whole comic started was when the Archies had the hit Sugar Sugar. And the Archies were a band put together in the studio just to pop out a hit single. And the song was a hit. It brought a lot of attention to Archie, the comic series, and they thought, we need to capitalize on that. Why don't we create a comic based on a band? And that's the history of Josie and the Pussycats.
Very interesting,
sir. Here we are right now, modern times, great take, and the ad for Riverdale.
Oh, yeah, I can't wait for Riverdale.
With the sunken boat in the river.
It's going to be awesome.
It's going to be good.
All righty. Well, there you go. Those are your comics for this week. Now it's time for our creator spotlight, the first of this year's interviews that you did at New York Comic Con, Mr. Daryl McDaniels.
Yeah, we're starting out with a big one. Daryl has his own comic line.
Daryl makes comics.
And he is a great guy who is completely devoted to comics as a medium. This is not a guy, and you'll hear in the interview how this all came about. He's not a guy that just said, yeah, you know what, let's make some comics. He believes in it. He loves what he does. The history of him and Marvel, I was getting goosebumps talking to him, because it pretty much is like talking to any one of us, like, oh, they had this impact on my life, and hearing him talk about education, how important it is. And then he drops a bombshell of his musical project that is coming out soon, which freaked me out. So you'll hear a lot of fun.
In the best possible way.
Oh my gosh, you'll hear a lot of fun in this interview.
Yes, I am envious that you got to meet him at New York Comic Con and I did not, but he is your creator spotlight. So we can all meet him right now.
Yes,
through our ears.
Yes.
So he is the creator spotlight for this week. We will put a link to the Daryl Makes Comics website in our show notes so that you can check out his comic projects. And did he announce a link for his... music?
You can go on YouTube.
Okay.
Because he told me what the thing was. But if you go on YouTube and you type in Daryl McDaniels, and I believe if you type in Daryl McDaniels and Miles Kennedy,
okay,
you'll get the song that the two of them sing together.
All right. I will try to track that down and put a link to that in the show notes as well. So that's your Creator Spotlight for this week. That is going to do it for this episode of the Secret Identity Podcast. So for Mr. Matthew Herring, this is Brian Lehtenry signing off. Have a great rest of your week, and we will talk to you in a few short days.
Go Nationals!
So the Creator Spotlight coming to you from New York Comic Con. It's a special one where we are doing one for Secret Identity Podcast and for 53.5, the official Striper Podcast. And we're here right now with a comic book legend now. We're going to say legend, musical legend. He's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Daryl McDaniel.
Yo, yo, what's up? DMC is in a place to be. The place to be is the New York City Comic Con right now.
And you're also wearing a Black Sabbath shirt. How cool is that?
Well, all I listen to is rock, classic rock, folk rock, and everything up to about, Nirvana, Alice in Chains, and Pearl Jam.
That's about where I end.
Yeah,
and
that's about where I end.
Isn't it great that we're seeing a lot of the bands that we grew up with, that you played with, some of your peers, are making some of the best music they've ever made lately? It's really cool.
I mean, you know, because they've always made good music, but now people are starting to realize that when they made all that great music back when they were younger, it's like playing a video game.
Yep.
The more you do it, the better you get. You know, a lot of music, hip-hop, rock, pop, and even country now is too packaged and computerized it's too much technology. There's no more life in music, because let the damn musician make the music instead of the damn computer.
And we're here right now. You've got your comic book line now. A year ago, I picked up the first issue of DMC, and I remember my first thought was, this is a fat book. And I'm not saying PFAT, I'm talking fat as in there was a lot of content. This thing took me a long time to get through.
Right.
You could feel the love in there, and obviously you grew up a Marvel fan, because you saw Marvel comics from the 70s everywhere, especially the covers, little cover gallery at the end.
Exactly. Marvel was very influential on inspiring me artistically, even as a musician. DC was cool, you know, Batman, Superman, Justice League, but the cool thing about Marvel was they had the superheroes really running around New York City.
Around your neighborhood.
Yeah, so as a little kid, I saw Hell's Kitchen, I saw the Lower East Side, I saw, you know, Times Square, Avengers Mansion was in Central Park. So it was giving me a education on a world which I really lived in. And at the same time, Marvel comic books also did stuff for my self-esteem as a young person growing up. I mean, you know, later on when I got into hip-hop and rock and roll, and I became a musician myself, an artist myself, Marvel comic books taught me to define myself in an adjective and then tell the world who I am. Like, you know, for example, the Amazing Spider-Man, the Incredible Hulk, the Invincible Iron Man. So when I got into this hip-hop thing and I had to, you know, tell the world who I was like, okay, I'm going to become the devastating, mind-controlling DMC. Thor, the mighty Thor, was the son of Odin, who had a brother named Loki from Asgard.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm Daryl. I got a brother named Alfred. I live in Hollis, so I came up with son of Byford, brother of Al.
Yeah.
Banner's my mother and runs my pal. It's McDaniels, not McDonald's. These rhymes or Darryl's, those burgers are Ronald's. So comic books gave me the blueprint for my presentation in hip-hop, to the point now people are going back to listen to, you know, all my Run DMC stuff, and they're discovering all the little Easter eggs that was there.
And it's interesting, too, that with the comic, a couple of years ago, I think it was a few years ago when it came out, you kind of were introducing a comic in a time when people were saying comic books as a medium is dead. It's all dead. And here we are right now, another sellout at New York Comic Con, busy and crazy.
Busier than last year.
And your booth is insane, and you also got a new issue coming out. So why don't you tell us a little bit about DMC, the character, and the company?
Well, the whole idea for me to do a comic book came about because I actually went to a music meeting. And at the music meeting, I was meeting with Riggs Morales, who is from Eminem's camp at Shady Records. And when I went for the meeting, it was about music. He said, yo, I usually don't fan out. I usually stay on point with what the business is about. But he was like, yo, I just want to know for a minute, you know, what was it like when you was a kid? And I was like, well, I went to Catholic school my whole life, and all I did was read and draw comic books. And when I said the word comic books, we stood there for 3 hours and we talked about comic books. So it was Riggs who said, yo, I want to take you to the Comic-Con this year. So he brought me here 3 years ago, and it just overwhelmed me, all the memories of all the books and all the toys and all the shows that I used to watch and stuff like that. And I just started talking about everything that I was into. And Riggs said, man, you should do a comic book, D. And I was like, nope, I don't want to do a comic book. He was like, why not? I said, I don't want to be another rapper just because I got a hit record trying to do something else. Yep. I want to stay in my lane. He said, yo, don't do the comic book as DMC, the celebrity, getting in a comic book as a business. He said, do the comic book as the little kid, Darryl, whose first love was comic books. So we decided to create the DMC universe, and DMC is the first superhero in the universe, but just to make people understand the differences in this universe, my superpowers is hip-hop and rock and roll. In the comic book, I never meet and run. I'm not a rapping superhero, nothing corny like that. I'm Darryl McDaniel, who's my admired little Catholic school kid who grows up to become a teacher. People always ask me, D, if you never had hit records with Run, what would you be doing? I was always a good student, and English was one of my favorite subjects. I mean, I got A plus, and so I would have became an English teacher. But in this universe, I'm an English teacher, so all the kids is doing punk rock, hip-hop, and rock and roll. But I'm the superhero running around the city fighting all the bad guys.
And it's amazing, too.
It's everything that I am. By Fred Banham, a mother and father, but it's just I'm not rapping.
Yeah, and my wife being a teacher really appreciated that as well.
My wife
is also a huge fan of yours, so I send her a message going to go interview DMC, and she's like, oh my God, it's tricky. That was the message
I
got.
It's tricky to rock around. Yeah, exactly. But that's the difference between this universe, the DMC in this world, and the DMC in that world. Is I never meet Run. Jam Master Jay is in the book. Now you have to figure out, why is Run in the book and Jam Master Jay isn't? So if you really know hip-hop, if you really know the history of Run DMC, it should be fairly easy for you to figure out why Jay is in the book existing in this universe.
Yeah.
So we wanted to do something. One of the reasons that Riggs could convince me to do the book, he hit me with this. You could do everything and more in this medium. The same things you did with your music, you could do that and more with a comic book.
Yeah.
People could hold it in their hands. It's visual. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? They could read it. They could see the colors. You know, it's no different from when you look at my comic book. It's almost like going back to the old school 80s with the graffiti and the style and the lingo. So all of that is existing in that universe as a constant. But the question is, it looks like the 80s. It feels like the 80s. It sounds like the 80s. But it could be the future. Because people always ask, it's in the 80s like universe.
It's a lot like the movie The Warriors, where they made it as it was supposed to be in the future, but you can watch it at any time period and get something out of it.
Exactly. And that's what we want to do. We wanted to create a universe that no matter race, creed, color, height, weight, or religion, you could relate to it. The characters are diverse. The stories are diverse. Current issues, past, future, and present issues. And the cool thing that we did, you know, even though it's superheroes, we deal with science. We deal with the occult. You know what I'm saying? So we're putting all the entities and all the possibilities of, you know, good and evil, horror, comedy, you know what I'm saying? And also history. And we wanted to incorporate all of those things into a book the same way that I did it with my music.
And the book, too, it's, like I said, it is fat. It is so full of stuff.
Yeah, we wanted to do graphic novel, thick type books.
And that's what it is. You get a lot of reading in there. So where can people find out, go online and find out? Because we don't want people stalking you.
Right.
Where can they go?
You can go to any comic book store globally to find this. But also you can go to www.darylmakescomics.com.
And what about music? You got anything going on there?
Oh, yes. I'm getting ready to put out an album at the top of the year. Right now, to give you a taste of what's about to drop, everybody can go to YouTube. You go to YouTube, you punch in DMC featuring Miles Kennedy.
The name I think we know that guy.
Yeah, the name of the song is called Flames. It's produced by John Moyer from the rock band Disturbed.
Wow.
Go listen to that record right now. It's up on YouTube. We did a lyric video because we didn't want to do the typical band seeing us playing, because we want people to read and feel what we are saying.
I am really psyched. I can't wait to hear that one.
The album is crazy. I got Joan Jett. I got Mick Mars from Motley Crue. I got Travis Barker. I got Sebastian Bach. I got Rome from Sublime. I got Sum 41.
Wow.
I got Tim Armstrong from Rancid producing me. This album is going to be a universal, generationally album full of fun, beach rhymes, and rock and roll. If I had to describe it.
As you were talking about it, I'm seeing everybody that's watching this interview happen going, oh my gosh, I think I like that.
So, yes, I think they will like the album.
So continued success. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us. Just have a great rest of the show and good luck with everything.
Thank you. Keep it rocking and keep it hopping and let's keep doing this.
The rest of the comic publishing world may finally be arriving to the party, but Drive-Thru Comics is the one that started it all. The first downloadable comic shop is still leading the way when it comes to digital comics. Featuring hundreds of publishers, excellent prices, and top-notch customer service, Drive-Thru is a great experience all around. Another thing that sets Drive-Thru apart from a lot of other digital comics platforms is this. When you buy a comic, you own it. You get a watermarked PDF file that you can read on your laptop, your tablet, phone, or any other device. You choose how you enjoy the comics you buy. So head over to drivethroughcomics.com today, and on your way to checking out, download a free issue of Secret Identity.